Penguin Random House Audio presents The Witch of Lime Street, Seance, Seduction, and Houdini in the Spirit World by David Jayer. Read for you by Simon Vance. Magic is the most perfect and chief science. Marcus Agrippa. Part 1. The Dead Boys. Behold, a ram caught in a thicket by its thorns. Offer the ram of pride instead of him. But the old man would not so, but slew his son, and half the seed of Europe, one by one. Wilfred Owen. The Borderland. A woman in a black velvet coat pushed through the revolving doors of the Grosvenor Hotel and, waving a miniature Union Jack in each hand, waltzed slowly around the marble hall. The gentlemen loitering there watched her dance past the sitting room that had been as subdued as a seance circle moments before. Almost as one, they put aside their newspapers and rose from their armchairs. Such a spectacle at 11 in the morning, in the staid Grosvenor of all places, could only mean one thing. The boys had done it at last. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle was among the first to cheer. For 4 years the famous detective writer had displayed unwavering support for the cause. He felt strongly that the war was worth the grievous cost. Like many parents throughout the country, Sir Arthur's thoughts turned at once to his son. Here was the sort of boy to whom the nation owed its gratitude. Captain Kingsley Doyle of the First Hampshires had fought with distinction at Arras and been wounded at the Somme. To his father's relief, he had recently been transferred to London. Sir Arthur had seen him less than a fortnight previous, looking his brave, steadfast self. Now, for all of them, the long struggle was over. A raucous cheer was heard from the street. The woman in black departed without saying a word. Following her lead, Sir Arthur rushed out to witness the great celebration of November 11th, 1918. He didn't know how so many flags could immediately appear, but they seemed to be waving from every window along Buckingham Palace Road. An old fellow was shaking a rattle as though it were New Year's Eve. Motors were tooting. The maroons were crashing. It sounded like all of London was banging away. Jostled by a rush out of Victoria, Sir Arthur lost his bowler. Picking up another man's hat, he joined the march to the palace. Toward the Mall, boisterous soldiers converged with munitions girls in overalls. A young girl hoisted onto the top of an omnibus led a crowd in singing Tipperary. But then something spoiled the moment for Doyle. A motor car pulled up with officers in staff uniforms and a hard-faced civilian. The man in plain clothes wrenched open a bottle and crudely poured whiskey into his mouth. Sir Arthur half hoped the crowd would lynch him. The British Empire had lost 1 million men. He felt no need to mourn them. Mourning was, so to speak, against his religion. The armistice was for him a day of communion and prayer. When Sir Arthur reached the palace, he didn't attempt to penetrate the cheering throng in the courtyard. Taller than most, he could see the balcony over the main entrance, festooned with scarlet and gold. It had started to drizzle. A crowd of soldiers chanted, "We want King George!" Moments later, he heard a single mighty cheer. The king, in his naval uniform, and the queen in a fur coat emerged from a window and stood on the balcony waving to the crowd. A sudden hush took hold as the guards presented arms. Officers stood at attention. Men removed their hats. The band struck up and 20,000 voices began to sing. Sir Arthur had never heard a more rousing rendition of God Save the King. 4 years earlier, under a bright August sky, Londoners then too sang the hymn and called for their regent. War had just been declared, and Sir Arthur had rushed to enlist. Despite being 55 at that time, he was a man with prodigious energy and verve. He still played a respectable game of cricket, broke 100 at billiards, skied the Alpine passes, raced motor cars, and was a crack shot with both a Lee Enfield and sidearm. Respectfully, the War Board turned him down. He resigned himself to training the old chaps in the Home Guard. Few civilians, however, were as informed of the Great War's progress as he, officially a mere deputy lieutenant in the Civilian Reserve of Surrey, for Sir Arthur had performed special service for the Crown. Asked in 1914 to lend his influential pen to the war effort, he wrote an effective piece of recruitment propaganda. To arms. The call of duty had also inspired him to undertake an epic account of the war, the British campaign in France and Flanders, for which the generals supplied the material. It was the younger men in his family who did the fighting. To arms, he had urged, and to the trenches they'd gone. From the beginning it had been a ghostly war. Something otherworldly had reportedly appeared in the sky over Mons, Belgium, where in the first action the British Expeditionary Force was overwhelmed by the Huns. Clouds in the shapes of celestial warriors were rumoured to have protected the small army in their retreat. First-hand witnesses to the vision seemed as elusive as the shades. Still, it became widely accepted in England that a miracle had occurred. Sir Arthur was not so sure. The German waves had met the best riflemen in Europe firing 15 rounds a minute. Had the British really needed ghost archers from Agincourt to save them that day in Flanders? The battle had affected Sir Arthur in a more personal way. His brother-in-law, Malcolm Leckie, had served valiantly as a medical officer at Mons and had died there. When a soldier died at the front, the Tommies would say that he'd gone west. Sir Arthur was fond of that expression. It suggested to him that the boy had taken a distant journey but was not lost to his comrades and family. He might, in fact, still be reached via some unusual mode of long-distance communication, such as trance-mediumship or automatic writing. As it happened, there was an eccentric young woman in his home at Crowborough in East Sussex who believed that she was a channel to the borderland where the dead and living might mingle. This clairvoyant, his wife Jean's best friend, Lily Loder Simmons, had originally been taken in by the Doyles as a nanny. Unfortunately, she soon developed a chest ailment and began forsaking her worldly duties. When three of her brothers were killed at the Battle of Ypres, her condition worsened. On warm days, Sir Arthur often read to her in the garden, where one could hear the dull thunder of the great guns across the channel. Later, in the evenings, in a room fragrant with flowers and medicine, Lily might take up a pen and practice spirit communication. One night, Malcolm Leckie's spirit supposedly possessed Lily's hand and came through in words Arthur and Jean recognised as his own. This was how the Doyles came to believe that the dead could be reached. Generally, Kingsley did not question Sir Arthur's views. Deferential and eager to please, he had studied medicine in accordance with his father's wishes, and when the war broke out he abandoned those studies at his behest. Religion was the only subject on which they disagreed. Kingsley was devoutly Christian, like his deceased mother, Sir Arthur's first wife, and viewed spiritualism as an occult faith. The growing sect had only a single tenet as far as Kingsley understood it, belief in survival beyond the grave, and only one established ritual, the séance. The worship of ghosts, as Kingsley saw it, was blasphemous and absurd. It dismayed him to see his father attempting to communicate with the spirits of dead soldiers and publicly encouraging the macabre practice. But he had no idea how large a role he himself would play in stoking his father's controversial faith. When the Foreign Office had approached Sir Arthur in the summer of 1916 to observe and report on the fighting, he eagerly agreed. For a gentleman with a military assignment, this first involved the traditional visit to Savile Row. Feeling a mighty impostor, he was outfitted for the front in a wondrous khaki garb his tailor threw together. A caricature, in his mind, of an officer, he watched as silver flowers instead of pips were attached to his epaulettes. Before setting off for Europe, he had pinned to his breast medals he had received 16 years earlier as a field doctor in the Boer War. Yet Sir Arthur, rugged and adaptive, was to be no mere parade warrior at the front. Accepted without ceremony, he soon found himself gripping a gas mask and crouched in a forward observation trench. Men leaned beneath the parapets, smoking and watching him curiously. "Holmes," one Tommy explained to another. A gaunt corporal sat on the fire step tending a wound to his leg. Spectral faces peered out from the dugouts and mine shafts. A shell hissed overhead. Sir Arthur saw the red flash by the German line as the earth shuddered. In front of him was no man's land, a misty stretch of craters, tree stumps, rusty wire and rotting dead, which he smelled but could not see. This was the
Sample complete. Ready to continue?